We did talk about a few issues last night, and we discussed them in terms of the common good, that which affects us as individuals, also affects us in the public life. And as we talked about that, well, after the session, Chuck Lutz reminded me of a phrase that was used often in the early 70s. I think Barry Commoner was the person who wrote about it. And that was, I think he might have even written a book called The Tragedy of the Commons. That is, that in the old village commons, people used to put their cattle out to pasture, and each individual sent their cows out there. But the tragedy of it was that as more and more cows were pasturing in the village commons, it became overused. This was used as an analogy. Come on in, please. It was an analogy for what's happening with the environment now. We as individuals, as communities, as nations, have been using the land, the seas, and the air to the extent, and abusing them to the extent that it has become a tragedy of the commons. That is, what has been useful for us as individuals becomes misused and therefore is not good for the use of anyone. The environment at this point, we may say, is not, some people will argue, is not all that bad. It's always recoverable. But as we've heard, through issues that have come up this summer in the news, the pollution of the seas, things just seem to be getting worse. Despite some legislation, it seems like the solid waste management is not working well. I mentioned plastics, we're being overrun with plastics. So I think you seem to be quite well aware of the problems that exist that we need to address. And it's this tragedy of the commons that environmental ethics addresses. We often think about these problems in terms of how they affect human beings and communities. And that's generally the way we were addressing the problems last night. We talked a lot about recycling, what we can do to avoid unsightly things in our environment and the detrimental health effects, etc. And we probably will get back to that. That's an important aspect of environmental ethics. We talk about how we ought to behave in certain ways in relation to the environment because of its effects on human beings. This is often spoken of, those of you who have some ethics background or are interested in the categories, is often called utilitarianism. That is, we look at each person's behavior in terms of how of its consequences, and sort of the means to the end kind of ethic. And this generally has been seen as an anthropocentric kind of ethic. It's how things will affect us as human beings. And I don't mean to imply that there's anything wrong with that. We need to do that. But I'd like to also look at a different way of viewing ethics. Some of you have, I'm sure, been aware of this. When you've heard stories of animal rights groups. Now that would fit into this next category that I'm talking about. There are many ways of speaking about it. Some of the terms that have been used for it are bioethic or biosphere ethics. In this type of ethical system, it's the inherent worth of the life form that we're talking about. That is, the animals and plants around us have inherent worth in and of themselves, not just as means to ends for human beings, not just as instruments for human use. This type of ethics, those of you who like terms, might be seen as deontological, that is what ought to be done. There are systems of principles that we ought to abide by. In this case, it's sort of the nature of nature to be respected, and nature has a claim upon us. One person who's famous for this that type of ethics was Immanuel Kant, the categorical imperative. I'm sure many of you have heard of or read about in that system. It is a set of principles that guides our action. Now, under this category, there are again many ways of approaching it. Albert Schweitzer was a person famous for, and early on, the turn of the century, who wrote about having reverence for life. Maybe some of you are aware of his writings. His was sort of an absolutist ethic. That is, he felt that nothing, no living thing, should ever be killed. That the respect, the reverence for life, extended to all animals. And I can't be sure about, I'm not sure about what he thought about use of plants, but it was just extended to all, and he really didn't have relative worth of animals, plants, etc. In a more recent type of ethics comes out of process philosophy. Have any of you heard a little bit about that? No. Alfred North Whitehead is one of the proponents of it. And that process philosophy has been taken up by quite a few theologians, one of whom, perhaps the most famous of whom, is John Cobb, who is teaching in Claremont, California. He's written some real interesting works. He and a biologist together wrote a book called The Liberation of Life. It's a real interesting and very readable book, sort of based on a process view of things. I won't go into this in a lot of detail because the philosophical stuff has its own language. But it's in that system also and based on the philosophical underpinnings, it teaches that all entities have intrinsic value, and therefore is very readily lends itself to this kind of environmental ethics, because it sees, in this case, not just animals and plants, but all of life and all of matter as having intrinsic value. And then for us, and that many of us are members of the church, and we'll go to this a little bit further in this section that I'll be leading on Thursday. That's Thursday morning. Our status as Christians, as believers in a God, a creator God, calls for an ethic and a respect for life, for the creation of God. We might see this as a relational kind of ethics. H. Richard Niebuhr is one of the people who wrote about this. The relationship with God is the basis for ethics here. And in relation to nature, we might say that because of what we believe about who God is, and who we are in relation to God, we believe that what God has made should be respected. So that covers sort of several different ways that we can view or talk about environmental ethics. Oftentimes, when we talk about the environment, concerns about the environment, we think of wilderness ethics. We talked a little bit about this last night. Some of you may have seen the film strip the night before, which talked about how we treat, say, the land up around in the mountains here, that's the fragile environment that gets a lot of use. And that's one type of concern for the environment. This is for the kinds of ecosystems that are not part of our everyday use, but have their own sort of a closed system. But then we also need to talk about the environment that we do use every day, our farming systems, our urban environments, and the seas and the air. I'd like to hear what you think about the various things that we've brought up so far. I'd like to get into it by talking about the idea of the rights of nature, the rights of animals. Have any of you heard of the work of animal rights groups? Yeah, I think that there are quite a few groups around the country now. I know in Northern California there are some very active groups, and heard of, over the last several months, one that groups that often protest the use of laboratory animals at the universities around the Bay Area. A group that protested the growing of the way that little calves are grown for veal. And I heard a kind of cute story that I'd like to tell before we do get into the discussion. It was over the public radio station that I was listening to on my drive up here just over the past last week. It was a story about a schoolgirl in the Washington area, I believe. Perhaps some of you heard this story. I think it was a junior high or early high school student who had decided she really didn't want to dissect the frog that they were required to dissect in their biology class. She felt that this was wrong to do and said she just wasn't going to do it. So, of course, went to the school principal and eventually, I believe it got into the courts. And the judge ruled that, is that correct? Did it get into the courts? Those of you who, yeah, I thought so. The judge ruled that she could be required to dissect a frog, but she could not be required to kill a frog in order to dissect one. And the school had to find a naturally dead frog. So what was cute about the story was that the news person followed around a naturalist looking for dead frogs. And they had all kinds of trouble finding a naturally dead frog because the frogs are generally eaten. They generally don't live long enough to die naturally. They're eaten by predators. So finally the story came out and said, well, there are these frog farms where they often have naturally dead frogs. So apparently the girl was able to come up with a naturally dead frog. But when we talk about animal rights, I think it could be sort of a case study for other types of use of the environment. What are the rights of animals? Do animals have inherent rights? Does nature have an inherent right? And when and in what cases do human rights, which might conflict with the rights of animals, take precedence? And I realize these are very broad questions. Have you thought about those kinds of issues?
Well, I'm concerned when the extreme animal rights people make it black and white, that, for instance, you can't use animals for experiments which would be really beneficial and have been proven at times. And then that extreme position makes everybody over here so defensive that you don't talk about the stuff in the middle that says, yes, but if we use them for animals, let's treat them with dignity, let's talk to them with kind words, and let's treat them with love. Nobody talks about the middle, it doesn't seem.
That seems to have been the case, at least for a long time. It sounds like now some groups are beginning to compromise a bit. Was it in the case of the growing animals for veal? The concern of that group was not the slaughter of the animals in and of itself, but the way that the calves were grown. They're grown in very small pens with no light.
They were shackled, actually.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that you can't have much of a reverence for life and treat animals that way.
Mm-hmm. So you feel that there is something about life itself that calls for us to have reverence toward it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was reading an article, and I can't remember now if it was Newsweek or Time, where they recently were talking about looking at animal intelligence and saying that, you know, we always think of animals as being stupid, and that possibly, particularly the higher mammals, really are very intelligent but have a different type of intellect or a different way of thinking. And it, you know, also brought in some of the questions about animal rights activities. And I don't know, being a nurse, I have some mixed feelings because I know we do benefit, but I know some of the experiments, and some of them are pretty gruesome. And yet I don't know how you can advance medical science without them. I think some of the things that cosmetic companies do just to test cosmetics or lipsticks or whatever are pretty frivolous, but I work with people who have spinal cord injuries, and I know some of the things they do to animals to try to figure out how you can regrow nervous tissue. And, you know, I'd like to see people being cured of these injuries, but the things that they do to animals are also awfully terrible. When we think of these animals as being stupid, that they don't perceive what we're doing to them. I don't really believe that. But yet I'm in a quandary personally about that.
Yeah, I think that's a really tough issue when it's a case of inflicting pain on animals in order to work with diseases or injuries that are inflicting pain on human beings.
When, and some of these, it's not just a matter of pain. They deform these animals. They disable them. They, you know, and then they live with the disability or the pain or whatever injury they do to them.
It does make you wonder what it does to the people that conduct the experiment.
Oh, yeah. I know what it does to people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it hasn't been that long ago. In fact, I think in many places still, they perform surgery on babies, on premature babies with no anesthetic because they think that they're too immature to feel pain when it's obvious that they feel tremendous.
We can't hear what's being said.
Maybe try to speak up a little bit, or if you can maybe move up a little. Yeah, there's plenty of room up front here. Please come in. Yeah, something that you said here made me think about the book I wanted to talk about. It's not in the bookstore here, but it's an interesting one if anybody has a great deal of interest in the ethical background for what we're talking about. It's called Respect for Nature. It came out pretty recently. Subtitled A Theory of Environmental Ethics by Paul W. Taylor. And in this, he talks about animal rights, but also it says that perhaps a better way of referring to it is maybe we can't say that animals who are not moral agents have rights in and themselves, but we as moral agents have duties over against animals because animals are moral subjects. That is that just may be a more helpful way of looking at it, that we have obligations and responsibilities over against animals. But someone also brought up, you know, that animals do feel pain, and we just don't know because of the lack of language. I don't know what animals experience.
I asked one time Leo Bustet about this difficult thing. Many of you know that he is a great lover of animals and a great lover of Holden. And he spoke of the need for some of the experiments because they definitely helped. But he said, he's the one that talked about that you have to treat them with love and kindness and dignity. And that the strange part is that the health experiments on them don't give true information if they don't treat them with love and care and concern, that the results come out different because the animal does have this response, even in the awful stuff you're talking about, to knowing that someone is loving and caring and trying to take care of them, and you'll get better health information.
That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. A couple other people wanted to go here.
What about the sportsman?
Oh, and hunt
animals for sport.
Hunter and fisher. Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Me? People who hunt and fish.
Yes.
What do you think? Or are you just raising the question?
I certainly don't like it when I think of when you do deer. I mean, if you needed the meat, that would be one thing. To do it for sport, purely, and then, which brings on the whole defense of gun control or like.
Yeah, hunting is a whole subject in itself, hunting and fishing.
So the same with just eating any kind of meat, because you don't need the meat to live most of the time. And you go down the store and buy beef, you didn't kill that beef, but somebody killed it so you could eat it. And I can see killing a cow or a fish or something if you're starving to death, but just because it tastes good isn't a good reason.
Mm-hmm. What if you take away the chicken, turkey, fish, which you'd have to take away if you take away all of any other kind of animal, then it seems to me you have to deal pretty hard on the land in order to produce the possibility of not dealing with any living thing. Creature.
But if you didn't feed all the grain that we feed to the cattle, and you fed it to people, it really wouldn't take quite as much as you think, because a lot of the grain that we could be consuming, we feed it to animals, so that we can feed on the animals.
And if we consumed it ourselves, it's much more efficient as food. It takes something like 100 pounds, these numbers are way off the top of my head, but it takes something like 100 pounds of grain to put 10 pounds of meat on an animal, where it would be much more food value to us.
How about the fish? Then we'd have to cut out fish if we're going to cut out everything else. We'd have to cut out the chickens and any kind of product of a living being.
Do we distinguish between animal life and plant life? Both are life.
Mm-hmm. They're all
I
living.
I guess you can't identify the plant, though.
Yeah, that's right, but I'm just curious because human beings must eat something that comes from living matter, or we die. And I guess vegetarians have resolved that in favor of not eating animals, but eating plant life. But that, too, was alive.
And I get confused about when I look at the natural order of things and how violent the whole creation can be in terms of getting its food. Animals.
Predators.
And I mean, not in a kind way often. And I guess my other thought about nature is just kind of the opposite of this, but I've recently been thinking a lot about how nature so often is around much longer than any form of human life in terms of number of years, and somehow the strength and integrity of a big tree or something that has lived for thousands of years. So it's an interesting bag, but I think the ethics of it are really difficult when you just look at how it seems to have all been set up by God, or, you know.
Oh, there aren't any easy answers to any of these questions, and again, it's I think a couple of you have sort of been advocating a little bit of an absolutist ethic that we've got life forms here, we shouldn't kill them. But then again, others of you have raised the questions. Well, then, how far do we take that? And can't we as human beings see any of the rest of nature as instrumental? Is that
something that I've found really interesting the last couple of years? The person I was talking about, the sport hunterman and fisherman, what's been happening in Minnesota for sporting contests is all the fish that are caught are donated to food shelves and nursing homes, and I think that's I like that.
Randy, I didn't hear the last part. What did you say? All the...
The fish that are caught during fishing contests...
Oh, in contests.
...are donated to nursing homes and food shelves, and so they are, in a sense, being used to help mankind.
Right. Well, man, I think my... You know, it's so hard in the era in history in which we're living now. You know, the process for progress is in motion. And I think that where it's really become very bothersome for me, or where I began to think about this, is where humankind have made themselves not a part of the natural order that God had intended, but has become owner of the earth, and that God has been pushed into the heavens, so to speak, has become totally transcendent in terms of our caring for the earth, and that we have quit the dialogue in honor or for progress' sake. And I think that that needs always to be in dialogue, because we as human beings really have taken on a power that God has never given us. God has given us dominion, which is stewardship of the earth, not authority over it. And I think that those are the things that we need to come to grips with as Christians, and whether we do it for sport and all of that, you know, it's like trying to hold back this huge dam that's coming at you and is just totally overpowering the earth. And how do we move back into a dialogue? And the churches are not leading the way. I think that that's one of the really crucial issues for me.
That's very interesting, Sammy. Who are the parties in the dialogue you're talking about? Or what is the dialogue?
Well, I'm talking about...
dialogue between...
The people, the expectations of people to have a purposeful, meaningful life. I mean, it's the people and the technocracy, let's put it that way. I'm not sure who the agents are, but our expectations are not being fulfilled. We're destroying the earth, and who knows where that darkness is going to lead. I don't have the two dialoguing people kind of peg, but I think that all of humanity's expectations, you know, are to lead a really... have a purposeful life, a meaningful life, and I think we come out of a mindset, particularly in the States, where we have overtaken all the Western countries in terms of technology and in terms of the ability to destroy the earth, and we have lost our mind about that.
Our consumerism too, it's a amassing of goods, and we think that the more goods we have, the more quality of life we'll have.
I'm just curious, in your own studies, are you doing anything in terms of what Native Americans thought about all this?
Well, that's a real good perspective to bring in. I have studied that in the past. I'm actually not working on that right now, but what someone said earlier reminded me of that. I think, I'm sorry, I forgot your name in the pink.
You're talking about me? Sammy Mayer.
You talked about the way that animals are treated, and Native Americans did use things in the environment, but when they went to chop a tree or whatever for using to build a canoe, they said a prayer of thanks for that tree and in a way apologize to the tree for having to cut it down. And I think that's a little bit of what you were getting at. It's an attitude of respect even for that which we use. And I think that makes a big difference in the extent to which we would use as over against abuse the environment. And that ties in with what you were saying, Sammy, about... sort of a blind use that technology has often just looked at nature as it for its use.
It's the difference between the Native American use of the buffalo or bison and the Europeans our ancestors' use of and abuse and elimination, practically, of the same species is striking and is horrifying.
They're usually in awareness of their need for the replenishing or for allowing that species to continue.
It was a sustainable use, right. And our use was basically to wipe them out, which we almost did.
At the same time, though, and I really like Native American spirituality and teachings, at the same time, can't romanticize that completely either, because there were societies, I guess, in the Southwest who did totally use it was a small group of people, small enough that they could use all of the resources in that area and then move on.
Yeah,
that did happen.
That.
I guess it's somewhat frightening that we aren't learning from those experiences. I'm from the Midwest, and this is a very dry year, so a lot of the duck breeding grounds and goose breeding grounds are dried up, and there's a lot of legislation in the working about not having a hunting season, and people are absolutely frantic about it. You know, rather than think, well, so we can't hunt one year, we may many years after that be able to. It's just the immediacy of what I can't do this year.
Yeah, they can't see that killing them off this year may mean that they won't be able to hunt ever again.
This is a bold decision. The judge who ruled that half of the fish were to be for the Native Americans. And that covers the area that I happen to live in. And I think that was at least 10 years ago that that decision was made, and it went through to the Supreme, U.S. Supreme Court and was sustained there. And I heard a member of our church within the last month say, I just think it's terrible how the Indians can get all those fish, and I have trouble getting the salmon I want. And so there is this lack of recognition that, well, the Indians make their living off of this. This was really affecting in the area was being fished up very rapidly, but it hasn't gotten across even to church people
right.
What this really means.
I would wonder if you would say a little bit more about process in all this, maybe not so much about the technicalities of process thought. But one of the things that I find very useful in that way of thinking is to remind ourselves that life is a process of constant change, and that we cannot arrest development at any particular time. And I say this sort of not to put a damper on the thoughts that we're having here or to be for exploiting the environment, but it does concern me a little bit that we might be falling into the trap of thinking that we ought to arrest nature right where we are now, rather than to see that, in fact, species have become extinct in nature. And maybe to confront the fearsome responsibility of planning that, rather than having it just happen. It may be that there are hard trade-offs to be made in this field that I'm starting to feel uncomfortable about making, but which I think are part of our responsibility when we think about environmental ethics.
Yeah.
How do we think about, is the snail darter, you know, something that we need to preserve over against a reservoir, which is not a good example maybe because it's balancing out human interests for power and energy as opposed to a life form that you won't find anywhere else. But how do we stop ourselves from romanticizing parts of this process and not seeing that sometimes the deer overgraze an area and then the next year, that natural cycles also include sometimes going to an extreme and rebalancing themselves and confronting the messiness that there are predators out there.
There are what?
They're predators.
Yes, right.
We're carnivores in nature, and we are omnivores.
But maybe that's where the dialogue comes in. It isn't either this or this. It isn't a black and white situation. I love the story. I think it may be National Geographic. To save the little baby seals up, and Eskimo hunters needed to hunt it for their livelihood and what was going to happen, but then the decisions were made. They couldn't kill the seals. And now the Eskimos are making money from all the tourists that are coming up there and photographing the baby seals. Maybe there's a whole new world that we don't think about because we don't talk to each other and find answers.
I appreciate that point very much, Mary. And a few things that were said along the way made me think of some things along that line. Part of our tendency is to think of humanity as totally outside of nature and the natural processes. And I really don't like that way of thinking. I think our whole history and even theology tends to sometimes support that view. But humanity, of course, is part of nature. We don't live without nature, without the ecosystem of which we are a part. And Teilhard de Chardin, we talked a little bit last night, had a view of evolution as including humanity. And he had a very positive, maybe overly optimistic view of evolution in that sense of humanity. I haven't used the word co-creating, but it was that sense of humanity and culture, including technology and information systems being all part of this web of life forms that are evolving together. And I think that can be a helpful way to look at what's happening in our culture. Our tendency often is to look at our abuse of nature, of technology's abuse of nature, and not to see the way that we can progress from here. But and it seems like the simplest answer to say, and I know that I felt this way for a long time while I was in college and later, that you've got to go back to nature, you stop progress where it is, stop technology from using nature. But that really is kind of unrealistic. And I'm not sure that we want to go back. You know, our civilization is evolving, and there are exciting things about what's happening in, I don't think it's all negative. I've been presented it that way so far. But yes.
Well, the truth is too, though, that if everybody lived like we did, I mean, the world cannot support the extravagant use that we have, you know. And somehow I think we need to see ourselves as part of the globe.
That's an excellent point. And I think the challenge is then to, and think about what Mary has said, how can we look at our use of the environment in terms of our part in a global system? And when we were talking about the vegetarianism, I'm not vegetarian, but I can see the value in it because our country, I mean our culture and Northern European culture, what are the statistics now? We consume 60% of the world's goods with 6% of the world's population or something like that. And so it's a justice issue as well as an environmental issue. How do we think we have the right to keep this up?
Someone has said that it takes 10 people from the country of India to sustain one person from the States, you know, in terms of the use of
the same amount of goods.
Amount, yeah. Right.
And I guess I didn't mean it so much in terms of the the standard of living that most Americans think of in terms of material goods. I think there are other things about technology and culture that are of value, and we don't need to be using as much of of the world's goods, perhaps, as we are, in order to sustain some of the valuable things that have come about through our use of the world.
That optimistic view you were talking about of mankind playing a role in the evolution of life on Earth, it would seem reasonable, I think, if the people on Earth as a whole were more in touch with more knowing about what is going on, and if we were clear on our values of where we saw ourselves going as a race. But right now, so many of us are so disconnected from the decisions that are being made by agribusiness, whaling companies, and all sorts of politicians that aren't really thinking about the future of the Earth and the future of the human race. They're thinking about next quarter's profits. They're thinking about things that are so totally removed from the values that we might come up with if we were to brainstorm something like that. So when we talk about the ethics and something like Too Hard to Show That, it's like, it seems like we're off the track because we as a race are so disconnected from
the decisions
we need to somehow democratize our society and educate people and get them involved with things before anything like that can really work, and the system of ethics, I think.
Yeah, I think that's really important, and that's sort of at the heart of a lot of the issues is education and awareness of lots of people, you know, not just people who come to Holden Village, but and I'd like to raise a question. I don't know if anybody has an answer for it. As you were talking, I was envisioning a kind of system that might happen, but given our capitalistic system and the right that every individual feels they have to make decisions about their economic good, I'm not sure it's possible, and that I think is part of the educational process too, that if we are going to make decisions as a community, we've got to discuss that issue itself, because I know my brother is a farmer, and he is one who throughout the years has always been against having any kind of regulation about what he should grow or what he feels like he should make that decision. It's a real strong individualistic kind of ethic about economic decisions, and that I think is one of the basic points that's going to have to be addressed. If that whaling company is making decisions that affect the long-term life of the species, should the rest of society have something to say about that? About whether that whaler is going to make a living by killing the whales?
Even within the present capitalistic system, if people were aware of the power they have to force a company out of business, to completely pull the rug out from under them almost instantly if they had the knowledge and the capacity to exercise the power that they really do have.
Mm-hmm. And then I think that's true. That raises the question, though, too, do we have the right to make that decision? And who has the right to make the decision that someone's livelihood, means of livelihood, should change because we think whales should be allowed to exist? And how do we weigh that? I think that's where the difficult question comes in.
And I think something else that needs to be addressed is the waste that occurs, especially in this country. This is going to sound strange, but I think Americans are too health conscious. What I mean by that is at my local high school, they bring in all these lunches in these plastic containers that the ones that haven't even been opened or touched, they throw away at the end of a meal. And why?
Well, could some of it perhaps be the fact that we have become a disposable society? We dispose of everything. I mean, even relationships are disposable now. And certainly whales are disposable. I mean, whatever is not oftentimes seen as something to be immediate use from
society. Where we're not, if some child then picks up that meal after it's been a couple of hours old, for whatever reason, not even related to the meal, gets sick, the school district's responsible for it.
Gets sued.
So then, no one, the parent's not responsible for the child, you're responsible for my child at school. So we no longer are even taking responsibility for that. That's why I see a lot of this waste is to cover your rear end.
Yeah.
Well, if it comes down to responsibility, though, I mean, we've not only polluted the planet, but this whole thing with the ozone layer affects, it's really a planetary issue. I mean, it affects the entire globe. And the consequences are extremely significant for everyone. And yet, I have a good friend who's working at NASA Ames Research on this very question. And the most they can do getting this information out to the corporations that are the major producers of the fluorocarbons, which get up in the air and do some horrible thing to the ozone layer, is they finally, it's like a big breakthrough. They have gotten one major producer of these fluorocarbons to agree to phase them out over a 5-year period. And the scientists are saying that if we totally stop tomorrow, that we've already done irreparable damage to this layer that governs, I mean, the drought in the Midwest is just the beginning of it. And yet it's like the information is out there, people know, but yeah, they don't care. It's not happening.
Yeah, I have.
There are two issues that are very current here. One is there was just federal law signed, to make this wilderness country just north of where we are. About 200,000 more acres. And the fight with the timber people did not want that. This wilderness land, so they couldn't go in there and cut timber. And we see timber cut, we call it clear cutting, and they say they will replant. Well, I'm still looking for some of that replanting, and furthermore, I think it's at least 50 years before the trees will be there again. The other issue is offshore oil drilling. And that is a very current issue here on the West Coast, where the Department of Interior wants to start drilling for oil on the offshore on our coast. And I think so far that's been blocked, but it's a real fight to keep that. Is there no limit? Will we ever run out of oil? Could that be?
It makes me think how we have kind of a warped sense of what progress is. That when you were talking about values and what we hold as important in our lives, it has to make a lot of money or push us ahead in the war race or arms race or the space race, where there could be. Somehow, if we could praise the things that, if we took a lot of our time and monies and energies that we put into getting oil from, the Middle East, instead of put that into developing other forms of energy that are less harmful, and then that got that the praise, you know, and the respect, right. And the, you know.
That's where I think that it is possible to influence things with the systems as they are now, or at least, well, the current administration has not put much money at all into research and development in solar energy or other forms of energy use that would be less abusive for the environment.
How quickly we put up the speed limits and started burning gas like crazy again. You know, it was so nice when we had to think about filling the tank. It didn't run around half as much.
Yeah.
And already, everybody's running 2-3 cars out of every house. There's things we could do ourselves that would make a difference.
That's very true. And some of the issues that raised, I think, are really good ones. And the question that you raised earlier about decisions that control economic or that control the use of the environment, I think, is a really important point. And it seems that eventually there has to be a system by which communities, nations, and worlds, some kind of, whether you work through the United Nations with a little more clout than it may have now, to control the use of, you've brought up the issue of the ozone layer, the one of the greenhouse effect, but all of those are eventually affecting the whole global.
And interestingly enough, just a couple of months ago in Seattle, before I came here, I heard the guy who is retiring this year from Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations very clearly say that the United States is not interested in making the United Nations a powerful force in the world, because as soon as that happens, we lose our power.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I think that's a good point. We're probably one of the nations keeping it from dragging
feet.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we could be in a strong force just by being first. If we want to be first, let's be first in protecting the global.
But what would happen is we're one of the problems. We're one of the major abusers. and
so it's big change.
Yeah, it would call for big change. And I suspect that our leaders really don't want global people, I mean people from around the globe, making decisions about what we can do in other countries, what we can and can't do. And that's the problem.
You know, there's an incredible arrogance that has been part of the United States policy for a long time. I mean, when we can mine a harbor in Nicaragua and then announce that if the world court chooses to censor us, we'll withdraw from the world court.
Well, that's like a child. The way a child behaves, isn't it? You don't like the way I play, I'll take my marbles and...
Yeah.
Just like to say one last thing. I remembered the wrong figure about the Indians. It's 40 to 50 that it takes to... I mean, I thought that 10 was too low. It's 40 and 50.
I believe that.
And the other thing, too, I think something we need to think about, too, is that in our church life as well as in our civil life, are we a people priority government and church, or are we simply a consumer and property oriented government and church? And I think the church also buys into that whole philosophy that bigger is better, and as long as we have the membership, don't worry, you know. I think that what's been said in some of my classes along the way is how we vote also makes a difference. And we need to watch who stands for what in those terms. Are they people-oriented folk, or are they just, we're going to make life better for you, you know? And maybe all of them have a little bit of both, but I think there is something to say about that.
Well, we're running on about 5 o'clock.
I thought it was really sad in the paper. I read that Admiral Zumwalt's son died, and he was the gentleman who gave the order to spray Agent Orange over to defoliate Vietnam. And his son just died of lymphoma, which they connected to the Agent Orange. And just made me think that it just, no matter what you do, it always comes home.
That's a very, very vivid example of that.
one bright side to look at is like in our city, in Seattle, they have really gone to recycling.
Yeah, and I've heard about that.
It's amazing. They don't have any garbage yard anymore.
Well, thank you all for coming, and I invite you to come.